This is the program that features reviews and interviews and changes the board a little so I can come through a little clearer. Devoted to the literary life of Carborough and the Greater Triangle Area. Your hosts are Paul Nage and Audrey Layden, that's me, on the airwaves here at 103.5 FM, as well as webcast live courtesy of iBiblio on www.wcomfm.org. To find out about our schedule of guests and to access our show podcasts, go to www.carboroughbookbeat.com. And we have with us today Nancy Peacock, who so many people have been saying you have to have Nancy on the show.
Yeah, Nancy, and have you been on other radio shows?
I have. I've been on Dick Gordon, The Story, some others that I just can't recall off the top of my head.
Yeah, well, we're glad to have you at WCOM finally.
Thank you. This is
definitely the all-volunteer but true community radio station in Carborough and Chapel Hill.
Absolutely the place to be.
This is the place to listen to.
So, and I'm so glad to finally have you on the show because it's given me a chance to take a look at what you've written, and it really is encouraging me to get some of your books because your writing style is just so engaging, and I found myself the little bits I was reading just chuckling from time to time because you're very sharp.
Oh, thank you. Yes. I think you were reading A Broom of One's Own.
Probably, but then I was...
I like to think there's some of them are funny in other places.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, so they are, yeah.
So you not only, you've written, you've done a whole number of things. I mean, I went to your website, which everybody, it is
NancyPeacockBooks.com.
NancyPeacockBooks.com. And it talks about some of the jobs you have. And this should be encouraging to everybody who's trying to write. I mean,
who writes and finds themselves still needing to be otherwise employed,
yes.
Which is about everybody these days.
Nancy, besides being a house cleaner, through a great many years of her writing, not currently is free of it, has done. She's newspaper delivery, waitress, clerk in three different drugstores, clerk in a hardware store, locksmith, carpenter, bartender in five different bars. Milker on a dairy farm. What is this? Small mucker.
Stall mucker. Yeah.
I switched my glasses too soon. Stall mucker at a horse farm. Bread delivery, farm worker, baker, assistant, drum maker, costumer, painter, house cleaner. Packing people's belongings for them, writer and teacher.
I was collecting data.
Yes. Well, it reminds me of the stories you sometimes hear.
This is a proviso. If you want privacy, don't hire a writer to do your dirty work because you might find it not so anonymously portrayed somewhere.
That's true. Never hire a writer to clean your house.
Right.
But, or to, who's the one that wrote the Nanny Diaries?
Or to keep your kids.
Right, exactly. So it's
maybe especially that.
Uh-huh. But it also reminds me of when you listen to actors and actresses talk about how they managed to support themselves until they were able to make a living.
Well, it's really hard, I think, to, if you're in the arts, to consider yourself, you know, a writer if you're also having to keep some other job going. I mean, it was hard to say that I was a writer when I was cleaning houses, even though I knew I was.
Mm-hmm.
I was published. I had I had reviews. I had a New York Times notable book. And yet I was sort of slogging around cleaning other people's toilets. Mm-hmm. It was a dual existence that was... actually, it turned out to be kind of compatible.
Well, one of the things you mentioned in something that I read before coming on the show is... how you took a year off to just write.
I did.
And you found that much more difficult than you had assumed it would be.
It was a lot of pressure.
Right.
You know, I thought, well, I was able as a house cleaner to only write for about an hour or two every day. And I thought that, you know, if I took the year off, I could maybe double my production at least. And I found that I actually can only write about an hour or two every day, no matter what else is going on. So I felt a lot of pressure. I felt like there was nothing to sort of engage in, except for my characters.
Right.
And there was a sense of unreality to it that, that I didn't like very much. It's nice to get away from the book.
Well, one of the things you said about house cleaning is that it leaves your mind free.
It does.
And it's something that, without referring to necessarily to writing, but finding... I have an appreciation for jobs that are routine, rote, that don't require your creative intellect. They require, you know, intellect, you know, a mind. You have to do them. But it's something that you can do without thinking about it.
Yeah, who wants to think about house cleaning?
Right.
I know that, you know, in Zen Buddhism, you're supposed to say, stay present, you know, and I kept on thinking, oh, I don't want to stay present with this. Think about something else. But,
well, what is the title of your essay out of the Room of One's Own? Is that's what is it, Ecstatically Cleaning the Toilet?
Ecstatically Cleaning the Toilet. And it's excerpted in, or excuse me, it's included in an anthology called Dirt, which is edited by Mindy Lewis.
And that just came out in May of this year.
That just
year,
came out, right.
Yeah. A Room of One's Own came out last year.
Came out in April a year ago.
Yeah. So this is, it's the whole topic of writing, which is more than just writing. It's, I mean, it's for anyone in an artistic endeavor, I would think.
Well, you know, when I wrote the book, it actually came about kind of in an odd way. I didn't know what to write. I was kind of at a low point with my writing. And a friend of mine who I've written with a lot said, you know, you're always writing about house cleaning. Why don't you write about house cleaning?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, okay. And I should have brought this, but I had the experience of being featured in the National Enquirer as the writer who cleans houses.
Uh-huh.
And so I just wrote that first essay called Inquiring Minds about that. And then I had the idea of just writing about taking a house that I have cleaned and then writing about my experience there and somehow working it around to my writing life. So every essay reflects something about my writing life, but it begins with my house cleaning. And that was a fun exercise to do. It was fun to see how it worked together. I hadn't, until I wrote this book, I didn't really understand that these two quote-unquote careers had actually worked hand-in-hand pretty well.
Yeah.
Well, I remember with the National Enquirer one where the guy just couldn't get them facts straight, you know, like suddenly you found you were married to a Dan.
I was married to a Dan. I'm actually married to a Ben.
Yeah, right.
Well, and he misquoted me, too.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, it's sort of like, well, what should she say? You know, rather than what would you say?
He had me say, I'm just a regular gal who loves to write. And I never call myself a gal. I never call myself regular.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Well, that's the National Enquirer. That's their reputation anyway.
It was kind of thrilling. It was hard at first. You know, at first I was like... Oh, my God. It was actually one of my clients, my house cleaning client, who told me that I was in the National Enquirer. She called me up the morning I was supposed to clean her house and said, congratulations, you're in the National Enquirer. I was like, what?
Yeah. Oh, my God. And say hello to Dad for me. Yeah. Right.
So I got there and read the article, and she was cutting it out to put in her scrapbook.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it took a while to buy a copy and think, okay, yeah, I'm all right with this.
So how did they find out about you? I mean,
they didn't. He interviewed me for a national women's magazine. And I think the women's magazine turned the article down. I don't know why. Maybe because I was a house cleaner. That's my guess. You know, I had mentioned being a house cleaner in other interviews, and it really wasn't particularly well received. I mean, people were always sort of, oh, well, okay, we won't talk about that. We'll, you know, we'll pretend you're some
this
big
is,
literary
it's
success.
It's the professional bias. You know, it's it's a class thing.
It is a class thing. You're right.
You know, it's like, you know, if you're a writer, then you belong to the intelligentsia, and the intelligentsia doesn't deign to do manual labor unless, you know, unless you want to get bucolic about it and talk about, you know, the
gardening or something.
You know, farming is...
I'm doing this just for my book, you know.
Yeah.
I think George Plimpton or something.
And it's definitely, we definitely have this class bias, you know. We have this fiction that if you have a college education, you suddenly are white collar.
Mm-hmm.
And I've I'm overeducated that way, and I've never considered myself particularly white collar.
Well, that's the other dirty.
Mainly because I don't wash my clothes that well, but that's another story.
Well, there's the other dirty little secret about my life. I'm undereducated. I don't have a college degree. Never went to college.
Uh-huh.
So that's also was not so well received.
But one of the things you did do it, but it took a long time because Nancy and I actually met a long time ago, about when your first book was just published, and I remember something you said to me at that time, which basically said you took a long time. Took you a long time to find your voice as a writer, in a way.
I think it takes everybody a long time.
Yeah,
really.
Probably right.
Even if you do go, I mean, if you go to college, you're sort of having a lot of voices fed into you. If you don't go to college, or my experience of not going to college was, having to discover for myself that it was okay to even have a voice, to speak up, up time.
But let's. Did you do the other thing that writers do, which is read?
Oh, I've always read, yeah.
I mean, that's actually that's what school makes you do.
Right.
In fact, I don't like going to school anymore. I hear all these people going back to school. I don't want to go to school because I'm totally self-educated.
They're going to tell you what to read.
They're going to tell me what to read, and I know what I want to read. I've got a whole pile of books, but I know what I want to read. I don't have any difficulty finding stuff to get absorbed in, but what were some of the reads that really affected you? This is usually where we sum up our show, which is the three books that most informed your life.
Oh yeah, this is one of my least favorite questions.
Well, it doesn't have to be just three books. We won't limit you, but
some of the most profound books for me have actually been nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
And books that are more about philosophy or about...
I call that a fiction of another kind.
Right. Yeah. One of them is The Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television by Jerry Mander,
mm-hmm.
which is a great book about the physiological effects of television. And
mm-hmm.
Drawing a blank here.
Mm-hmm, that's all right.
You can just pop them in it as we go.
Yeah,
I'll try and keep it in my mind. But
yeah,
think of these.
But we do have this. We do have this contrast between physical labor that engages the body, and the imaginative life, which is the way you're writing. You're writing in the imagination, developing the imagination. So, for instance, do characters for you become independent parts of your persona? So suddenly you're woken up and you've got little Carrie in your mind saying blah 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 blah.
Yes.
And they're talking about their lives in ways that you couldn't have imagined before.
Well, they're independent, but they're not parts of my persona. I mean, I guess maybe they are if you want to get down to the nitty gritty, but they sort of become their own people and start telling me what their story is. And that's when fiction really works. It's when
mm-hmm.
I'm not in control, but they're taken over. So, I think the more the writer becomes invisible in fiction, then the better the fiction is.
Well, I remember once in a case where I was writing something, and what I was writing was not what I wanted to say.
Uh-huh.
But the characters, the poem or whatever it was I was writing at the time, said, this is what has to be said. I didn't want to write that. I didn't want to say that stuff, but that's what came out.
Well, I really struggled with my second novel, Home Across the Road, because it's written from the point of view of an African-American woman. And being white, I struggled with whether or not I had the right to do that, and
mm-hmm.
whether I was going to embarrass myself and offend people. And in the end, I had to go with that character to
mm-hmm.
tell this story because she was the most reliable narrator. So that was, it's always important for me, not all writers, to have a reliable narrator.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is why I went with Cedar in the first book, Life Without Water. She was the child of the hippies who lived in the commune.
Right.
The hippies didn't know what was going on. Cedar did.
Uh-huh.
The child did. So, it was a struggle with China Red, the character of Home Across the Road. I mean, she really kind of beat me up a little,
mm-hmm.
Just I went in places that were wrong for her, and she let me know it.
Mm-hmm.
And I could feel that it was wrong and had to go back.
Do you ever sometimes start out with one character thinking that will be the prime mover of whatever you're writing, and it turns out another lesser character steps up and takes over center scene?
That has not happened to me. Usually because I don't get too far along with a character who's not right, you know, who's not the voice of the book. I can't get too far down the road with that.
Right.
I've heard of that happening.
Yeah. Because I was just thinking of this something I've been working on off and on for a number of years, and started out with one particular idea, and another character who is part of a subplot is going to take over that whole book.
Wow.
It's changing the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, and they do change. I mean, things have changed within the books for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Home Across the Road had a pretty complex plot and a lot of characters, and so I made an outline of what I thought was supposed to happen, and that outline was subject to change.
Right.
I'm not a writer who works with outlines generally. I just kind of had to have a little bit of a map
some kind
for
of
that
framework.
Book.
Yeah, you had a map because you have so many people.
That's
right?
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I tell people in my other part of my life is just you pick a direction with the understanding that that direction can change.
Right.
But if you don't have a direction, you never take any action.
Right.
And action begets action, and then you be flexible enough to say, well, I got started, and this is not my original direction. You go off on tangents, which can be much better.
Well, that's the great thing about art.
Yeah. So it's a matter of being open to what's around you and accepting of it, as long as you keep that in balance.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
But the imagination in the classic sense is a gateway not only to that's used for writers and in a variety of ways, but the imagination is also a gateway into aspects of experience, mind, and intuition that one normally doesn't access. I mean, you know, the imagination is much more powerful than it's normally given in school in particular. You know, they don't talk much about the imagination. So, but I'm thinking in terms of psychic experiences of the other world. All of this stuff takes place in the imagination, not because it's not real, but because
It's imaginary.
Yeah, not because it's imaginary in the derogatory sense, but because that's the way you access these things. You know, every psychic is told, trust your imagination.
Well, and creativity has to do with the subconscious.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about thinking something up. It's about putting something down.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you a story about in Home Across the Road. There's a story about a pair of earrings made out of abalone, and they're mistakenly called Abilene. Well, I dreamed the name Abilene. I mean, I was having trouble with this book. I was maybe, I don't know, I might have done two drafts, and then I dreamed this name, Abilene. I liked it so much I wanted to put it in my book, and I created this whole earring story, and the entire book hinges on that story.
Mm-hmm.
So I needed that, you know. Mm-hmm. I was glad I was paying attention.
So your ear rang.
What?
Your ear rang.
It did.
Yeah. One of the great
things. Glad you made that
dreams.
Joke calling on me.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, our unconscious has a very strange sense of the pun.
Yes, that's true.
Well, tell us a little about A Broom of One's Own, which is your most recent book, besides your inclusion in the anthology. What is the reader going to get from reading this?
Well, I hope the reader's going to get, you know, encouragement for their own creative life, mm-hmm. for whatever that is. It doesn't have to be writing, I think, to get something out of this book about creativity and about process and about, you know, just what you may have to do in the meantime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was not always pleasant cleaning houses, but mm-hmm. I had chosen a job, I realized, that and I knew it at the time, that was not too taxing on me. I mean, house cleaning, I could go in, do it, in 3 hours I was done.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then I pretty much had the day.
Mm-hmm.
When Paul met me, I was working in a grocery store. And that was kind of taxing, because there's a lot of customers, you know, there's a lot of people talking to you.
Uh-huh.
It's not as though you just your psychic space is taken up with stuff.
Right.
So house cleaning was good for me. So, I mean, I do tell people, or I have suggested to people, that they not... You know, I think it's hard to have a head job and try and write at the same time. You want to give your brain a rest when you get home.
Right.
Yeah, I agree. It really does help. I mean, for years I was a cook for the same reason. That the head stuff I wanted to do was what I was really interested in. I wasn't going to get paid for it, so okay, I'll be a cook. You know, it was pretty straightforward, and I didn't poison anybody during the time I did it, so it was okay.
Protecting yourself, protecting your psyche.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's also hard to lend your creativity, which is such a personal thing, to somebody else's purpose. That's something I found. It's hard for me to be creative according to someone, like being an ad man or something, or writing advertising.
Write
copy.
Me a poem about.
Yeah, I mean that's. It would be hard to do on a regular basis.
I don't even think I can do it on one basis.
Yeah,
I'm really bad at that.
Well, you know, if you've got a lot of words in your head, I mean, and you just if you like doing prompt writing, somebody says write me a poem about something. You could probably sit down and write a poem.
Well, then I do. I teach this prompt writing class at the library, at Chapel Hill Library, once a month, and it's next week, August 8th, from 10 to 12. If anybody wants to come, just show up with a pen and a pencil. And all we do is I'll throw out a prompt. You know, some of them have been write about what's in your refrigerator, write about your bed. I'll give. Sometimes I give, like one thing I did was I gave a list down one side of different things like feathers, water, bottle caps, and then other side was bridge, house. And you had to, you ran your finger down either side, and you had to write about building a bridge with feathers or something like that. And it was, you know, it was fun. And then I set a timer for 15 minutes, and you're supposed to write nonstop. And the deal with writing nonstop is that, you know, you shut down that editor inside of you that's like saying, no, this is wrong, this is stupid. Mm-hmm. And you just go for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot of fun. So you can also just learn a lot of what you can do in 15 minutes if you allow yourself the freedom.
So do the people then share some of what they wrote?
They do. We read them back to each other. There's no pressure to read back.
Right.
So, you know, different people read back. It's got a kind of primal feel to it. I've been doing this for about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's amazing what people write. It's and it's amazing, I think, in this society that a lot of people just don't have permission to just tell a story, to just speak, to just create art without it being some kind of
big deal.
National deal.
Right.
You know,
right.
And everybody's an artist.
It's one of the things you say is in your growing up that one, I think it said something like in the fourth grade when you were getting some encouragement from one of your teachers, but also that you were kind of shy and you grew up in a loud and noisy family where the only way your voice could be heard, even by you, was if you wrote it down.
Right.
Whether anybody else read it or not. So you that was kind of your refuge or your way of expressing yourself.
Right. And it's still a refuge.
Yeah. So something I mentioned before we got on the air was about how journal writing, for one thing, is such a valuable way to preserve your mental health sometimes.
It is. I mean, if you, especially for me, if something's bothering me, I mean, I just start writing it out and it becomes a little bit more clear why it's bothering me or, you know, if I'm just being crazy or if there's really an issue here. Or, it's not always pleasant to go back and reread all that stuff.
Right.
And I don't really recommend it. But it's good. It's good. I have my journal with me right now.
Well, it's just good to be able to separate yourself to some degree from what's going around in circles in your head.
It's a good tool.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you give a free class at Chapel Hill Library, but you give a number of other classes as well charge.
I have a studio in Orange County, a little small place that I call the Treehouse, and when I rented the treehouse just to write in, I realized, it needs to pay for itself.
Yeah.
So I started some writing groups. I've got four of them going now. They're all women. It's just for women, which just evolved that way. And, you know, it's a nice way to make a living, and this is what got me out of house cleaning.
Not the books, the writing classes.
Oh, no, not the books.
How interesting.
Didn't get me out of house cleaning.
Interesting. So if somebody wants to find out about the classes,
they can go to my website,
which is
nancypeacockbooks.com.
Okay, and check it out. Now, do you want to give us a little rundown of what you have?
I have three classes that are sort of a combination of prompts and critiquing. Mm-hmm. So this is for people who have works in progress,
right,
who want to
right.
bring stuff in, get it critiqued. We do a prompt at the beginning of the class, just 15 minutes, and then we have readbacks, and then each student can bring up to 10 pages,
mm-hmm.
and we have an oral, discussion of that work,
mm-hmm.
and then I take those home and bring them back with a written critique.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have one class that it's just prompts, and that's mm-hmm. on Friday mornings.
All right.
So, yeah.
It sounds like you would enjoy doing it.
I do enjoy doing
it.
Yeah.
I'm midwifing a lot of works right now,
uh-huh.
which is a lot of fun.
Yeah. Does that interfere at all with your own writing?
Well, it would be easy to say that it does, but I think it doesn't.
Okay, good.
I think there are fallow stages of mm-hmm. writing in which you have to just stop and refill the well and
right.
recognize that that's what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But I wrote two books while I was, teaching these classes,
mm-hmm.
and I could do it. I think
mm-hmm.
one of the things that it does that's really cool is it keeps me involved in the process even during those fallow periods, and talking about writing to other people in the ways that I have to as a teacher has been really good for me.
Mm-hmm.
It lets me understand the whole process a little bit better.
Well, actually, this reminds me you talked about the fallow period, which I think I also agree you have. There's times, where there's like taking in.
Right.
And you don't know what you're taking in, but you're taking in, and it's not time to produce or to transform or things. What kind of, do you follow a discipline or a routine? Do you have like do you get up at 6 a.m. and write for 2 hours every day? Or do you have any, do you follow a routine like that at all?
It was easy when I was house cleaning to follow a routine because I had to. So there were times, during my writing life of when I was house cleaning that I would get up at 5 or 4 in the morning and write for a couple hours before I had to work. And then, I knew I had to quit because I had to go to work. It's a little bit more difficult. My time is more fluid now. When I'm working on a novel or something like that, I like to write in the morning, right out of the dream state. But it's hard to give up my mornings, too, because I like to take walks in the mornings. And it's always the best time to vacuum
right,
as well.
Yeah, that's right. It's not a great time. Noon is not a great time to go on a hike. I noticed
this time of year.
No.
So you're writing now. You're still writing.
I'm still writing, but I'm in a fallow period.
Right.
This is my fallow period. I'm actually working on haiku.
Uh-huh.
I've just discovered haiku, and I'm sort of playing around with that. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Actually, one of the tarot groups that we do we give our readings as haiku.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so
that's cool.
You get one or two cards. You don't have to do too many of them. And they say, okay, I come up with your 17 syllables about this reading that's relevant to this person.
Right.
It's amazing what people come up with.
I bet.
With that limitation.
So you recommend writing as a way of life?
No.
No.
I can't recommend anything as a way of life,
right.
really. I mean, I think earning a living is just hard for everybody.
Yeah.
That's just the bottom line. And people who seem very successful may not be happy with their jobs.
Right.
And what does it mean,
right.
successful? Like you've got a lot of money and you got a big house, maybe not.
Well, yeah, we have this dream of a security. Now, security isn't necessarily a lot of money, but security is sufficiency, so that, I'm not worried about being homeless next week.
Mm-hmm.
So there are people, and there are people who think that, well, I will, take 20 years and do this thing I hate, or I don't, that doesn't turn me on, because I will then be able to earn this security. A lot of people were terribly dashed in this last year.
Oh, my goodness.
Where they thought they had, created their security and then find it to suddenly evaporate.
And I feel for them because they kind of play the game by the rules, And I mean, there's these sort of quote-unquote rules, I think,
mm-hmm.
of how you're supposed to live your life.
Yeah. And
things will work out if you do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then the system changes and it's a lie. I mean, we've had this happen in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
there was the savings and loan fiasco back in the 80s, you know, which again, thousands of people lost their retirement and life savings. You know, and the thing is it's the little people that they don't get bailed out. I mean, that's our system. You know, if you're super wealthy, well, we'll provide you with some welfare. But if you're poor, you deserve to be that way.
It's true.
You know, so in action, and we do have this mendacity in our society, or in mass society, which is, with the healthcare debate that's going on now, is that, you know, we're probably going to create another fiasco that will continue to enrich people, and that we're enriching people on human suffering. For me, is an ethical quandary which nobody addresses. Why should we have a healthcare system that's for profit, that makes people rich, when it's really based on human degradation and suffering?
I'm with you.
You know?
I think there's two conversations going on there. One's about profit and the other's about health care.
Mm-hmm.
And one side's talking about one thing and one side's talking about another. And it's not resolvable unless you're talking about the same subject matter.
Yeah. And the thing is people confuse it. They confuse it. They think, well, you know, I'm employed. I'm okay. You know, they don't know that. You know, nobody is employed, in the sense of being free from, finding themselves uninsured these days.
Right.
But I'm speaking to the choir, no doubt.
Yeah. Let's get back to writing.
Well, I'm just thinking of things to be unfallow about.
This is a question I think anybody who's ever considered writing is up against, and that is, how do you get published? Do you find an agent? Do you just send it out over the transom to any publisher you think might be amenable to what you're writing?
My best advice, if you want to get published, is to pray.
Okay.
Because I don't know.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm a published author. It happened to me in this one certain way.
Well, how did it happen?
It happened that I took a class from Lee Smith.
Uh-huh.
She's a wonderful person. She liked my work. She has a lot of contacts.
Uh-huh.
I was working on a novel, and I was sort of sending her chapter by chapter. She was just being very supportive this way. And then I revised it. And she just mentioned me to John Yao, who's an editor at Longstreet Press, which is no longer in business.
Uh-huh.
And she called me up and she said, you know, send him three chapters or send him a query letter and a chapter or something
uh-huh.
like that. And so I did that right away.
So it was the good old girls.
It was the good old girls. And she, you know, he asked to see the rest of it. I didn't hear anything back for, you know, months.
Uh-huh.
And I knew, you know, don't bug this man.
Because right.
there's one rule is don't bug the editors because
right.
they got a lot of work.
Uh-huh.
And they're always looking for a reason to, like, get something off their table. And if you bug them, there's a good reason right there. This person's bugging me. I'm going to send their book back.
Right.
And
right.
So, you know, he finally contacted me, I think, just before Christmas, and a one-line little letter saying, you know, I hope to persuade my company to publish this. And then I didn't hear anything back for 3 months. And then
did you jump up and down and holler and yell all over the place, get all excited?
No, I was pretty tense.
Yeah,
until the 3 months were up and you got a call.
There were unknown hurdles to get over.
Yeah, I know, but still being recognized at all.
And you have no control over it. That would drive me crazy right there. You know, at least, you know, with writing, at least you supposedly have some control.
Well, and now the publishing industry is just changing.
Oh, yes.
You know, vastly and mm-hmm. fastly, and you know, it's hopefully for the good, but it's a big transition mm-hmm. right now, and I don't really know that they know what's going on or what they're looking for or how, you know, mm-hmm. so I'm the worst person to ask about this.
So, you've joined the blogosphere, haven't you?
I have not.
You haven't joined you haven't decided to blog occasionally?
No, I'm blogless.
That's what we just mentioned.
I wish I could say that, but it ain't true, yeah.
I'm just learning about blogging now by, as I had mentioned earlier, a friend starting a writer's blog for mutual support, more or less.
I got kind of dragged kicking and screaming into the whole internet thing. I mean, it's huge that I have a website.
Uh-huh.
It's huge.
Uh-huh.
Or email.
Right.
So, you know, I'm taking it a little bit at a time. I think you can get really swept away with everything you're supposed to do.
Right. Well, so many now people are talking about the writing that goes on online.
Right.
And e-books and, right. and things of that nature. And we spoke with someone recently who had actually found a publisher through the fact that he had self-published on, or he had put it out on Kindle right. or something.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, what he had done is he had the Kindle edition of it, made it really cheap, so a lot of people
right.
read it, including a couple of agents. And
he had self-published it?
Yeah.
He self-published it and it could go on Kindle. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, in other words, and he just dropped the price down to, you know...
like a buck and a half or something.
A buck and a half, uh-huh. 2 bucks, you know, so... Well, what it did is it got a distribution, and it made right. notices that is that his book for a couple of weeks was up in the top 10 of Amazon. See,
that's a smart person.
Yeah, yeah.
That's,
well,
that was a way
our,
of
that
sort
was
of...
our felonious jazz guy who
yes,
was just
exactly.
just at the regulator uh-huh. this Friday, reading from that. Which it's a fun
it's
novel,
a good mystery, yeah. murder mayhem.
So
book.
It did it get picked up by a publisher then?
Yes,
right.
yes,
it's Great.
Been it's been picked up by a mainline publisher.
Well, see, that's an example of somebody yeah. who really kind of knows how to go in the back door.
Yeah,
and I
yeah.
think that's a lot of that's,
and he's
and
a,
that's
he's
happening
a journalist.
More and more
yeah.
yeah,
yeah, these days.
Yeah,
so.
And there's a guy who whose name of his book I'll have to remember it because I'm actually part of this thing. He's got a 2-week-old website which is going to be his entire novel, and what he offered was free access to the first 100 people that signed up.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, you know, free access, yeah, beat that. You know, it's $10 otherwise. So I accessed it for free, and I'm looking at it's a science fiction novel.
Uh huh.
So I'm starting around the second or third chapter. He's promising to produce a chapter a week, and the book will be done in 3 years.
Well, that's good for him.
You know,
he set up a schedule for himself.
Yeah.
And 3 years.
It's a lot of chapters.
50 some odd chapters.
Well, no, actually, I think it works out to about 33 chapters, but. But
okay.
it's broken down into subchapters
okay.
or something.
Okay.
You know, and it has various subgroups that are interested in it. You know, like, you know, there's the magic subgroup and the,
uh-huh.
and the science fiction subgroup and the alternate history subgroup, you know.
So when I was writing Life Without Water, I set up a similar sort of schedule of just deciding for myself randomly that it had 12 chapters
mm-hmm.
yeah.
and that I would write a chapter a month, and that this was during first draft, and that regardless of how I felt about that one chapter, I was not allowed to like continue playing around with it at the end of the month. I had to move on to the second chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of writing is to remember you got to keep it moving forward,
right.
even if
right.
you're not happy with what you've written.
And this
you
was
can revise
revision.
It. Yeah,
yeah. Revision.
With my two writing mantras are no one's going to do it for you,
mm-hmm.
and you can fix it later.
I live
by them.
Right.
Well, yeah, I'll never get past the first sentence. I sit around and, well, let's see if I move this word over here and I move that word over there. Yeah, substitute this word here.
What you got is a really good sentence.
Yeah, yeah. I got a sentence, but it doesn't say anything, you know.
Well, that reminds me of a mantra that someone else once gave me, and that is, done is better than perfect.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Well, I'll remember
yes.
that one. I'll remember that one.
That's one that keeps coming into my head. It's just, okay, just do it.
That could be said for house cleaning as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's another thing that I have to just sort of kick myself to do. So it's...
Being a man, I never think of house cleaning except once a year maybe, you know. I finally, you know, I'm getting tired of my feet sticking to the floor. I think it's time to, sweep and mop, you know. Yeah. Well, that's a different thing, yeah.
I find it better now, talking about house cleaning, and when I'm living alone. I think now is one of the first times in my life I'm living totally alone.
Uh-huh.
I've got my own place.
Stays cleaner, doesn't it?
Yes, it stays cleaner, one thing.
Right.
And I find it easier to do something like that when no one else is around. If there are people around, I don't want to clean house. I want to talk to the people, you know, or whatever.
Well, it's hard to clean house when they're not cleaning house, too.
Yeah.
You know, it makes you
yeah.
feel a little,
Yeah. So I was kind of like, yeah, well, let's invite somebody to come over, and that'll make me clean the house.
Well, and as a house cleaner, I hated it when people were home.
Yeah, uh-huh.
You know, I much preferred being there by myself.
Because that allowed your creativity just
to allow me to think what I wanted to think, and I could cruise around the house in the way that I wanted to cruise around the house, which is sort of task by task rather than room by room.
Right.
So it's much faster that way,
right.
You know. And you know, folks don't understand there. They're sort of like, oh, I'll be out of your way, but they're not.
Right.
And they want to talk, and I don't want to talk.
Yeah.
I'm not
want
to clean your house.
Right. So you do actually have some sort of a schedule that you set for yourself when you said you write a chapter a month, and at the end of that month you're going to have to leave that chapter and
right,
go on
that's
to
what
the
I
next
did for
month.
Life Without Water.
Right.
I did not do that for Home Across the Road. That was the one that I was writing when I took the year off to write. And I was under contract for that one, so that was a really different experience.
Having a deadline, I would think, would help. In some ways.
It did not help me.
No.
I don't like deadlines. I think this is why I didn't like school. You know, I'm
right.
really good at sort of imposing my own deadlines, but I'm not really good at following other people's deadlines.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I know a lot of writers who need deadlines, but...
Yeah.
And maybe I should get one, but...
Well, if you're...
If they want to give me some money, I might, you know, but other than that...
Whatever works for you.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever motivates, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's one of the things I found that some friends, or not actually friends, some relatives, like my daughters and other people that are close in the family, we had a 10-page club for a while, and we had to write 10 pages a month. But we're too close, and we're too much alike. So if one person came in and said, well, you know, I could only get 5 pages this month.
Too kind to each other.
We're too kind to each other. That's why now with this blog group, well, it's with friends, but it's still, it's different.
Right.
Because it gives this little thing you kind of have to live up to the fact that, yes, you say you're a writer. Let's see you actually write something.
Right.
So explain this blog group. I don't think you've explained it to the audience out here.
Well, it's brand new, and it's only by invitation, I understand. But it's basically... Well, I'm learning about blogging, for one thing. So it's basically a support group online for people who are writing.
Yeah. I mean, it is to have your straight thoughts available online right away.
And if you run into problems, like I've got writer's block or I can't seem to make myself do it, then you get somebody come up with some ideas about what you could do. And,
it's hard to tell the difference between writer's block and that fallow period.
Yeah.
I think.
Maybe I've been fallow for most of my life.
That's one way of thinking about it.
Well, I've done a lot of things, so at least I've got enough. They say you should, some writer or teacher or something told me once that you should not write about anything that happened in your life until it was 10 years in the past.
I've heard that.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Something like that. It's like 10
People
years.
People are full of advice, though.
Yes.
Yeah, but that's useless advice because, I mean, sometimes it's the angst and the discovery of the angst. Like, if I wanted to write about falling in love, I would rather want to have my initial draft when I'm going through the intensity of falling in love with all the obsession and all the detail and all of that. Now, it might be that that would not be necessarily good copy, but I would, you know, I'd want it there. And then, you know, and after my broken heart and all that other
falling
stuff.
Falling in love things, always have to come with a broken heart.
Yeah, of course, right, After all of that, you know, it's also, well, with me, that's, you know, then maybe I could polish it off. You know, get the phrasing right and the rhythms and stuff, but, you know. So.
Well, I have found that with poetry, in that I, seems like the only time I write poetry is when I'm really upset about something. I mean, really deeply emotionally in angst or something, which fortunately doesn't happen too much, so I haven't written a lot of poetry.
Good.
But that's when it just comes out in poetry.
Right.
And it eases it. That's
this is interesting. You write poetry when you're angry, and I only write poetry when I'm in love. So I have a very slim volume of poetry.
Well, I would say angry, angst, in pain.
Angst, in pain.
That's different. That's a way of getting rid of the pain.
Yes. So, Nancy, going back to the what do you like to read the books that have changed your life.
But they don't have to change your life, that you really enjoyed. You think everybody else should read.
Yeah.
One book that I really enjoyed, I like memoir a lot, was From the Mississippi Delta by Indisha Ida Mae Holland. And I read that when I was working on Home Across the Road, because I was reading everything I could by African Americans. And, and she does some, it's a very interesting book. She writes in dialect, which I'm pretty much opposed to, but I mean, it's her dialect. So if she wants to write in her own dialect, I'm fine with that. If I was to write in somebody else's.
Did you ever read any Pauli Marshall?
Pauli Marshall, no.
Yeah, she is a wonderful African American writer. Tense poetic spirit. Anything by her.
Uh-huh.
Pauli Marshall. It's Paule Marshall.
I'll look for that.
Very, very good writer. I don't know if she's local. I know she's not local, but she's definitely a great, great African-American writer. And actually, we should mention, as you mentioned that, we should mention another person we had here, Kate Betterton's book.
Oh, right.
Yes.
I blurbed that book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where the lake becomes a river.
Right.
Very, very nicely done book.
Yes.
Thoroughly enjoyed reading that.
Yeah. Actually, one of the things we might do sometime is get writers together on our show and let them talk.
Oh, wow.
Well, we try to let them talk now, Paul. Sometimes I have
one
to kick them
time.
Under the table. So we've got two. We've got the four arguments for the elimination of television. We've got From the Mississippi Delta.
What are some books that you like?
Okay. It's something just pops right into my head is The Cloister and the Hearth, and I can't remember the author's name.
Thomas Hardy. Isn't that Thomas Hardy?
No, it's not that well-known a name. But it takes place in the Middle Ages, and it's historical fiction. Extraordinarily well written. It ends up being you find out at the end that the main character is Erasmus. So it's just excellent. The Dune series, I mean, entirely other thing. Anything written by Tom Robbins, anything, his earlier books, his recent things, I'm not getting the same thing out of
it. You didn't
Jitterbug
that
Perfume
much,
and Still
Cowgirls.
Life with Woodpecker. It just, the man invents language as he writes. It's just incredible. I don't know if you're familiar with his book.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I read his, he writes, Cowgirls get the blues.
Right?
Yeah.
So I once, as a Christmas present for family members, made a list of just 50 books that I remember.
Oh, that's a
having
nice present,
read.
Yeah.
And gave them each gift certificate to Barnes & Noble.
Oh, nice.
Along with his 50 books that I remember having read.
One of the books, or a series of books that have been really huge for me, actually, now that I think about it, are the Little House books by Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Oh, yes.
And I read them, and I still read them. And they're really great books for me.
Huh, I've never read them.
Oh, I love them.
I read a couple of them aloud to a kid, in a place in my life when I was reading books to kids. And I remember reading them, and they were great. They were very engaging.
Yeah.
I read the Narnia books to my kids. So I like those too.
My father he had leukemia, and he was in the hospital having chemotherapy, and and I went to visit him one day, and he had this big stack of books, and he was going through them, and I said, "What are you doing, Dad?" And he said he was rereading all his favorite books. I mean, he knew he was dying, and he was rereading all his favorite books, starting with McGuffey Readers,
which he had
as a child, and going on up to the Tolkien trilogy, which he read every winter. And I went home from that experience, and I thought, I'm going to reread the Little House books because I've never read them as an adult. And I did that, and they were incredible. They were so comforting at that time in my life, when he was dying, to reread my children, books that he had read to me as a child, and to rediscover them and think, oh, these you know, these are actually really good books. It's right. not just that I was a child. It's, right. These are good books.
Right.
Well, there's another thing, though, too, which is the voice. You have the still always going to have that voice of your father in your head with those books.
That's probably true.
You're going to hear them, and yeah. that way, you know, they so they carry with them that that you know that semblance of you know specialness. That,
yeah, I actually still read them if comfort is what I want.
Yeah,
I'll read a Little House book.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, I like the misogynistic Anatomy of Melancholy by Robert Burton, which is an English professor's book.
So many times. I'm going to have to look at this book one of these days.
Yeah, well, get the one that where most of the Latin has been translated. It's a little more interesting. But the it was written by this Oxford professor, you know, who was, you know, he had to be in orders, you know, to be an Oxford professor in those days, which meant that you never married, so he didn't have anything nice to say about women and, in the book at all. And he quoted, and he had it all backed up with all the misogynists of the classical and middle age period to go along with it. But the that's only a small portion of the book. Basically, it's why you know why one is depressed, and the whole book is this encyclopedia.
Because
you
don't like
depressed.
Women. That's really depressing.
It's only
you know?
Yeah. Well, actually, you could. But one of the things that, as they said, as one cynic said, he says, well, you know, he also was a practicing astrologer, and he predicted the day he died, and he killed himself that day so he wouldn't be wrong.
Just to make sure.
Yeah.
You know? So,
So
he's right about everything.
That's true. Well, the romantics liked him. You know, Shelley and Byron and all those people were quite taken with the Anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was from them that I found out about the book, and then I discovered it myself, and I just wasn't able to put it down. There are non-misogynistic parts about the book. You know, mm-hmm. he talks about lovesickness and its various forms, and how to cure lovesickness.
Has he been
a
in
good
love?
Good physics. Well, yeah, he was saying what Virgil had to say about you know,
Virgil lovesickness.
Yeah, yeah, you know, what Virgil had to say. You know, Plato or Aristotle. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. So what's next on your agenda? Nancy.
On my writing agenda.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a working title?
I know you're in a fallow period. About?
Yeah, this is a hard question when you're in a fallow period.
Right.
I don't know.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I had started a novel.
Uh-huh.
And I'll probably return to it.
Right.
But
any working titles?
I prefer not to say.
You prefer not to say what the working title is?
Yeah, no.
It's sort of like it's an escape persona, you know?
Yeah, this is a really hard question because if I'm involved in a writing a book, I don't really want to talk about it.
Right.
You know, it's sort of like the more I talk about it, the
less it gets written.
The less it gets written, exactly. Mm-hmm. And there's a tension to just holding it inside and trying to get it on the page that's real necessary.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm in a fallow period, you know, I don't have a lot to say. So that's a hard question.
Well, there's I'm sure there's a lot to be said. There's lots coming to the roof in there. They're all there. They're waiting. They're coming.
Yeah.
Well,
that's a nice thought.
They're coming. Yeah.
That it's not necessarily that you have anything specific in the future, but you are a writer.
I like to think you will be
a writer for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And hopefully without having to go back to house cleaning.
Oh, I'm not going back to house cleaning.
Right.
My back won't take it.
Uh-huh.
One of my students said one of the wisest things I've ever heard, I think, about writing, and she said, writing is not just about output, it's also about input.
Uh-huh.
And I just, I opened my little journal and wrote that down.
Uh-huh.
So I would always remember that. I think it's really important to remember that. And, you know, this is a hard world to have input in,
mm-hmm.
because it's sort of a corporate world, and
mm-hmm.
and writing has become a corporate pursuit a little bit.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's publishing houses or corporations, and
mm-hmm.
and you know, they want their books quick.
Right.
They want them quickly, and they want them, you know, to be profitable, and that's a hard environment to be a writer in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, we do. How to resist the corporate mentality? I don't know.
We are doing it right here.
Subversively.
Well, one thing, listen to
WCOM. Yes. Yes, where we interview local authors, renowned and unknown.